I mean, let's face it, it all boils down to one simple thing, kindness. That's what it's all about. So when we look at money and our relationship with money, we could just say, is this money helping me to be kind? And actually, if our objective is to get more money, we've missed the point.
Welcome back to the Most Hated F-Word podcast. I am your host, Sean Maslick. Thanks for tuning in this week, where I get to have another fascinating conversation about the human experience of money. And this week, I am pleased to have Chris Budd on the podcast, where we talk about the cornerstones of financial well-being and why setting financial objectives as goals often leads us to feeling unhappy. Chris is the founder of Ovation Finance, a financial planning firm that he started in 2000 and sold in 2018 to his employees. Since selling his company, Chris is on a mission to really impact how we think and feel about financial well-being and how it's not just about becoming wealthier, but also happier.
I would say, rather than saying, how can I use my money to be happy? We should say, how can I be happy? What's money got to do with it? The amount of money you need to be happy, in my experience, is generally an awful lot less than you thought it would be. My conclusion is that more money will make you more happy if you need money to be happy.
Chris is a qualified coach. He's a podcaster producing the Financial Wellbeing Podcast, which I will link in the show notes. He is an author, have published 6 books in total, including 3 novels. One of those novels Chris is really proud of, and that's The Vanishing Point. So I encourage you to check out that book in amongst his other ones, such as The Financial Wellbeing Book and The 4 Cornerstones of Financial Wellbeing. Chris is an experienced speaker, and during our conversation today, you can tell how articulate and engaging he is when he talks. Chris is a cricket coach, and as he says, he can play guitar as well as Eric Clapton can sing. On this episode, we dive into what is financial well-being and why is it so important for us to have a meaningful and purposeful life? Why we need a different approach to money? Because the one that we're used to, where the accumulation of assets seems to be the sole purpose, isn't necessarily working anymore when we examine it from a context of well-being and happiness. This conversation felt really good for me. Chris is doing some fascinating work. I encourage you all to follow along his journey as he's really bringing more happiness and well-being to the money conversations. Speaking of conversations, if you've been enjoying the conversations on the Most Hated F-Word podcast, you can help support the show in one or two ways. You can head over to Apple Podcasts and leave a review, or you can share this episode with a family, friend, or colleague, anyone you think would enjoy this conversation. And now, I hope you enjoy this fascinating conversation with Chris Budd. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Sean. I'm sorry it's so cold with you, but you're probably used to it by now.
Yeah, we're getting used to it. It happens every year, but we complain about it every year.
There's a line about, well, who should we pick? Let's pick Yorkshireman from Yorkshire, England. How do you know someone's from Yorkshire? They tell you. How do you know it's cold in Canada? They tell you.
They tell you. And guess what I did before we started recording? I told you it was cold. Well, Chris, I was delighted to find your work and your books online. And as I was going through your content and your work, I just felt that your writing style, your way of thinking aligned really, really with the way that I think. And I thought, well, I'm going to send this guy an email and see if he'll come on podcast. And look at this. You said yes. So I am delighted to have you on the podcast. And while we're going to dive into your books, your work, I thought we would start with, I guess, maybe some outcomes of financial well-being in your personal life. I understand you perform in a band called Consumer Duty. Perhaps let's start here. What is the origin story of Consumer Duty, and how, if anything at all, has it impacted your own financial well-being?
Yeah, it's an interesting place to start. So I'm a lover of music. I've got thousands of CDs and thousands of vinyl. And I play guitar. I like to say that I play guitar as well as Eric Clapton sings. And Eric Clapton's an okay singer, and I'm an okay guitarist. That's all, you know. So I'm a busker. But Consumer Duty is a name of a compliance regulation in the UK at the moment, a new compliance drive. And so never let the drummer name the band. That's the message here, right?
Okay.
So the drummer, Ian Beeston, lovely guy, was asked to put a band together for the big annual conference, the PFS, Personal Finance Society conference. And he got in touch with me, and we got a couple of other people. So we formed this band, rehearsed a few times, and we had a total of 1 hour rehearsal altogether for a 1 hour, 15 minute gig. And we got away with it. I don't think I would go any further than that. But we played a few gigs since and got a bit better. And now we play 2-3 times a year. And it's great fun. I love it. I would describe myself as somebody that loves being on stage, but I'm happy at the back. So I'm a high functioning introvert. I love being on stage and making the party happen. But when somebody turns around and applauds, it's like, yeah, whatever, whatever. I'm not fussed about that. It's nice, obviously, but that's not why I'm doing it. I love making things happen and getting parties going and getting ideas flowing and all that kind of stuff. I would just say, Sean, that you've caught me at the end of a day where I've been working from home writing. And so I seem to have lots to say.
Yeah, well, that's good.
Hold me back, maybe.
No.
No. All right. I want to say one other thing. I've got an article I haven't got published yet. I'm kind of saving it up. And it's called How to Be Moderately Successful. And I really like this article. It's 10 tips of things to do to be successful on your terms. So I get a little bit bored by LinkedIn people saying, I've been up at 5 a.m. this morning. I've eaten my beans and I've run 15 miles. And I'm like, it's so boring. It's so boring. I nap. Right? This is the last social taboo. This is, I think, number 7 of my tips on helping moderately successful. I have a nap every day. And it's quite fun when you get a corporate type wanting to have a meeting and they say, can we meet at 1 o'clock? And I say, oh, I'm so sorry, I can't make that time because that's when I nap. And then they kind of go, but are we serious? So I can't, something you said at the very beginning put me in mind of that article. Okay, well, I'm sure I'll put more bits out of that article because I really like the idea of 10 things to do that are kind of the opposite of what business gurus would tell you to do. The things that will make you happy, not make you rich necessarily. They'll be successful on your terms.
You know, this idea of how to be happy instead of rich, it really speaks to me. And I wanted to talk a little bit about your background so people can get to know you. And I think this is the part I'll enter it. You have a long career as a financial planner, I believe 20 so years. But I understand in 2015, there was perhaps a colleague, someone who politely asked you to take a break. And it was
that's right, yeah.
And it was during this summer that I believe you really found out not found out, but you can elaborate, but you really came upon this idea of financial well-being and started to, I guess, formalize it a bit more. And perhaps on your comment on being rich and happy, maybe you were reflecting more on, I guess, on these two terms. Can you just expand more what was happening to Chris during this summer and how was this financial well-being idea born?
So there's a few starting points we could choose. One of them is when I was in my mid-20s, my father, who happened to also be a financial advisor, went bankrupt. It ruined him as a person. I've dwelt on this and thought about this for many decades since. But his pride was taken. And I came to realize that this because he came from a very humble background and he did quite well for himself. And his pride was based on external sources. His sense of self-worth is based upon what he could show people that he owned and how hard he'd worked. And that external sense of self-worth is exhausting and out of your control and can be taken away. So that's one thing that's worked me through over the years. Then there was the day that I went to see the doctor with what they called a muzzy head. This was about 2011, 12. And the doctor didn't know what to do really. He didn't have a pill for it. So they were a bit stumped. I said that than the old classic Dr. Google, and I thought it might be depression. What did the doctor think? So she perked up then because she had a form for that. So she gave me a form for me to take away and fill in, and I can still picture myself now. I came back, sat at the kitchen table, And you know, when you're at school, you used to have these photocopy bits of paper that were all crumpled up and bits skew if on the page, they've been photocopied so many times. You know, it was like that. It said depression questionnaire at the top. And question number one was, how many times a week do you feel like killing yourself? I was supposed to fill this in and take it back 2 weeks later. So I very quickly realized she couldn't really help me. But at the same time, a friend of mine asked me if I could do some coaching. Sorry, I could be coached by her as part of her training. And three coaching sessions changed my life. Because in those three coaching sessions, I learned two very important things. Number one, the source of my depression was that I wasn't writing. I wrote novels when I was younger, got out of the habit, and I've since written six books, including three novels. The second thing that I realized was this coaching thing's pretty good, isn't it? So I went to train and became a business, took 2 years to become a qualified business coach and started applying that into my practice. And suddenly the conversations I was having with clients were completely different. We stopped talking about money. We started talking about life. So I wanted to delve deeper into that when I had a summer to write a book. And then the third thing that happened was a lady that worked for me, my PA for many, many years, Sarah, lovely lady, resigned, wanted to do other things. And she said, phrase that cut me to the core. She says, I don't just want to spend my career helping rich people to get richer. Oh, that hurt. That really hurt. Because she was right, you know? Yeah. She was right. So a combination of those things meant that when I sat down to write my book about money, I wanted to create a book that would help the public to create their own financial plan, but it needed to be a financial plan that would make them happier, not just wealthier. So I started researching the origins of happiness, sources of happiness, and I came up, so a line that I love to say, Sean, I mean, it's kind of tongue-in-cheek, but it's also true, is I actually invented the phrase financial well-being. I just didn't know that two other people invented it before me. But that is actually true, because the name comes from my wife's a cancer nurse, and there's a local cancer center that she was working at the time, and they use the phrase well-being all the time, living well with cancer and different things, this sort of thing. So I said to my wife, I'm going to write a book, and I think I might call it How Financial Planning Can Help Prevent Cancer. And she looked at me and went, I don't think that's a very good idea, actually. Very wise lady is my wife. So I came up with this phrase, financial well-being. I then Googled it to see if anybody else had used it before, and there were two entries on that Google search. Now, if you Google financial well-being, there's something like 320 million uses of that term. So I spent that summer researching the origins of happiness and its relationship to money, and I haven't stopped since.
Fascinating. And it's so interesting as you recount your story, these like four key moments that you reflected back how they, I guess, coexisted together to create this book during that summertime. You started out talking about these external sources of happiness. I just want to talk about like financial planning as we know it, as I've heard you call it 2.0, and how it's really focused on these goals or these objectives that are external in nature. I've heard you talk a lot about the issues with having goals per se. So why don't we start there? What is the issue or could be the issue of these goals, especially from an external financial planning perspective?
I feel you've got me, Sean, because if you've heard me talk before, you know the places to push, which is great. So let me give an example of a guy that I coached once. He had sold his business and for quite a lot of money. And he had many millions of pounds in his current account, plus an investment portfolio, plus nice house paid off, et cetera, et cetera. And he described himself as bereft. Such an emotive, powerful word, bereft. So I asked him, what is this money for? And he said, I don't know. All his life, all his professional career, building up this business, his accountant and his wealth manager had said to him, you need to get to financial security. That was their objective for him. That was the goal, to get to financial security. When he got there, he didn't know what to do. And that's my problem with goals. Michael Phelps famously won 8 golds at the Sydney Olympics and then had a nervous breakdown. Goals isn't enough. Goals, for me, I think are best as steps along the way to purpose or motivations. We can then dig into what does purpose mean. But if we're too focused just on a goal, goals stop because you achieve them. And then there's something on the other side. But what? I look at somebody like Cristiano Ronaldo, you know, one of the greatest football players ever to live. And he's now playing, I don't know where, Saudi Arabia or something. Not for the money. He doesn't need the money. He's doing it. I mean, he can phone me up and tell me I'm wrong here by all means. But it seems to me he's doing it because he can't stop. Because no one's ever talked to him about what happens next. Retirement is a classic. I'm sure you and many of your listeners will have seen many people who have got to retirement and then gone, oh, is that it? What now? So understanding the sources of joy and of happiness is about understanding whole of our lives, not achieving a goal. Oh, I've just remembered why I thought of that article, by the way, because one of the other points is, you said, thank you for saying yes to this chat. One of my principles is I try and say yes to everything. The thing you hear a lot on LinkedIn from entrepreneurs and wealthy people is you've got to make sure you choose what you do and say no to things. Ah, say yes to everything. See what happens. Lots of interesting things can come. I've done so many interesting things because I've just said, yeah, all right, I don't know what you asked me, but I'll give it a go. Obviously, there's going to be times when you've got to put a lid on that sometimes, especially if the diary gets too busy. But yeah, just don't have set goals without thinking about what happens when you get there. So yeah, goals I don't like really, especially not on their own. They can be a means to an end, but not as the end itself.
When you put in this context, your words was the whole of ourselves. It really rings true to me. It's like how goals in itself are quite isolating. And to your point, it's what do we do after? As opposed to, it sounds like what you're saying is purpose can come in and help create that whole of ourselves where we can have a goal. But to your point, the goal is a stepping point to something bigger. How do you envision, or perhaps you can speak from the book, how do we integrate this word purpose? And my question comes from, at times I've heard people seem to shy away from purpose, being like, oh, that's too big, grandiose. And I think LinkedIn or other social media have almost made it seem like this purpose has to be something like changing the world is the yeah. only purpose you can have.
Yeah. Sometimes you see people who are new to, so you mentioned the 2.0 thing, financial advice, technical, version one, financial planning, technical plus cash flow, thinking about the future, version two, financial well-being, thinking about what future would make you happy, version three. You come across a lot of people who have only just discovered financial planning, version two. And I sometimes see them on social media go, so excited, because it's just such a better way of doing things, right? And they might say something like, I had an amazing meeting today, so emotional, had a client crying in my meeting room. That's not necessarily a good thing. What I want to say to those people is, let's just calm things down a little bit. Easy, you know. Let's not try and change the world because your clients might not be ready for this. And the example I give for myself of that is I used to say, the line I would use would be that well-being, joy comes from living a life of meaning and purpose. And one day it suddenly struck me what was wrong with that sentence. So I changed one word. And now I say well-being comes from living a life with meaning and purpose. Of meaning and purpose makes it sound like we all need to be Buddhist monks. We all need to go around, you know, changing the world and every single step. No, just help out at your local, you know, baseball league, whatever it might be. One of the things I'm most proud of that I've ever done in my life was I set up a local cricket club in my local village. It was just me and my two kids and some of their friends, one team. Just me running it for several years, and then slowly but surely the club started to realize something was happening here. Now there's 180 kids every Friday night during the summer playing cricket. And I'm as proud of that as anything I've done. And I will go down there on a Friday and just have a beer and just look out and just remind myself. So it doesn't have to be huge. For any financial advisors listening, just ask the question to somebody, where does meaning and purpose sit in your life? And that could be time, it could be money, it could be both. But just, I mean, let's face it, it all boils down to one simple thing, kindness. That's what it's all about. When we talk about what is purpose, you know, I talked about my father's self-worth was external. That implies that a better source of self-worth would be internal, which is feeling meaningful and having purpose in life and self-actualization to use, you know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, whichever framing you want to use. Buddhism will just make it much more simple and just talk about be kind. And it's not a bad start, really, is it? So when we look at money and our relationship with money, we could just say, is this money helping me to be kind? And actually, if if our objective is to get more money, we've missed the point.
To quote you just that last sentence, if the objective is to have more money, we could be missing the point. If I think back to this financial planning 1.0 or 2.0, that was the objective, the accumulation of money. And as a financial planner myself, I reflect back and see like, holy smokes, at times I was really helping pushing this narrative forward that the accumulation of money is the answer. I like in your book how you bring up, is it X Factor or Dragon's Den? Or maybe both. But anyway, regardless. We have this narrative out there that success success is, this is success. And I even have felt myself meeting someone who's like successful in that way. And you're like, ooh. But to your point, Friday night, 180 people coming out to play cricket, that is impactful. So can you just speak to this idea of how do we as an industry start to redefine what success is?
I think there's a few ways. Firstly, there's a line in Ireland, in Southern Ireland, which is one of my favorite lines. You're driving around the countryside and you get lost. You see somebody by the side of the road and you say, one of the window, excuse me, mate, how do I get to so-and-so? And they go, well, I wouldn't start from here. Now, I think that could be a title of a book. I wouldn't start from here. I hope you don't mind me mentioning, Sean, you mentioned earlier on that some people have told you to be more niche in your podcast. I rail against that. It's a part of this just say yes kind of principle. Similarly, if there was one word I could ban from the English language, which one concept I could ban, it would be the word monetize. How do we monetize this? I recently went on holiday to New Zealand, and it really struck me. There's a phrase that I came up with in my head, and just a framing in my head of the salt crust of our Western life. What I mean by that is we were sat by the side of a beach and we were having lunch, and it was quite windy, so there was spray coming over. And as you came away, I felt my arm, and the water had evaporated, leaving a bit of a salt crust. And it just occurred to me that this kind of, it's in the air. This salt crust is a concept in my head anyway of what's just always in the air. In New Zealand, their starting point, see, it seemed to me from my 3-week holiday, their starting point was very often about well-being and nature. That was the first thought. And then you go to other issues. Whereas I think in Northern America, certainly in the UK, our starting point is, how can I make money from this? So if we buy a piece of land, how can I make some money from it? Some friends of mine bought a piece of land to stop it from being built on by developers, which is a fantastic thing for them to do. They were then going to rewild it, which is another fantastic thing to do. And then the next time we look up, there's some horses on it. Well, there's nothing wrong with that. But the principle was, I've got to make some money from it. I was talking to somebody recently, he's a property developer, and they'd bought a holiday home. And he wanted to rent it out over the summer to make some money from it. And his wife said, no, we're not doing that. And for a property developer, that was just, whoa, you mean have a property and not make money from it? But that's our starting point. How do we make money from it? In New Zealand, we went on a helicopter ride near Queenstown, which is by a massive lake. And there's two big islands in this massive lake. And I said to the helicopter pilot, who owns those islands? Because that's the sort of question I would ask here. Because they would have a jetty saying private, keep off. And it would be owned by somebody who would have a house on there. In New Zealand, they were both nature reserves. And I just really hit home the difference between what's in the air, the salt crust of our Western life is, how do we monetize this? As opposed to, am I enjoying it? Is it fun? Is it making me happy? Those are the things, those are the priorities we should start from. So that's the starting point bit. We're starting from the wrong place. One other quick way I express this in the book is there are three simple steps to a great relationship with money. What you do is you start at step two. And step two is realizing that joy comes from internal sources, not external sources. That if your happiness lives on the other side of somebody else's approval, you're always chasing somebody else's approval. But if my sense of purpose comes from knowing I set up a cricket club 10 years ago, youth cricket section, that's always with me. That's in my control. So that leads us to step three, which is, well, where does self-worth come from? And that is being kind. To quote Archbishop Desmond Tutu, a lovely phrase, joy is your reward for the giving of joy. Oh, love that one. So now we've got to step three. We can now go back to step one, which is to create a financial plan. But now we can create the financial plan to a destination of well-being. Whereas what we tend to do, both us as people, but also financial advisors, financial planners, whatever, is we start off with assuming that financial security is the objective. Then when we get there, we go, great, now let's get to step two. Well, it's too late, guys. You actually got there ages ago. If only you knew what, know what step two was. So three steps, you start with step two, then step three, and then you can create financial plan.
Chris, my body feels good listening to that. It just, I don't know if I should edit that out, but it's true.
No, keep that in. The best compliment I've ever had.
But my curiosity is just peaking. Why did you put them in, like, step one is the financial plan? How come you didn't put that at the end of step three?
More dramatic that way, isn't it?
Yeah, okay. Okay, I like it, though.
I think it just gets the point across that we're starting at the wrong place. That's why.
Yes, okay.
Because what we tend to do is we say, you know, like the guy who sold his business, you know, he had a financial planner, he had an accountant, and they told him, your objective, your goal is financial security. And when he got there, he went, great, now what do I do? Oh, I don't know. And he's bereft. Whereas if he'd started with step two and then step three and understanding where joy comes from and then create this financial plan, his life, the previous 20 years would have been completely different.
That idea of starting from the wrong place, I think, is so important. And it's reminded me of a section of your book. I think it's the start of it where you like the first page, the whole page is we need a new approach to money. And I'm hearing this is that we need, because we're starting at the wrong place. Let's speak as individuals listening, because for the practitioners or advisors listening, they're also individuals. So let's focus on I'm niching here, right? Individuals, not a group of people. As an individual, I would assume this starts with one of your cornerstones of know thyself. Let's go into your cornerstones and start with this significance of knowing thyself and not glossing over that part, because I think it's really important.
Yeah. The top two of the cornerstones are what's true of all of us and what's true of you as an individual.
Actually, can you just clarify what the cornerstones are? I didn't really introduce them well for the listeners.
So there's four of them. And this is just a way of me, all that I've read and learned over the years, a way of bringing it all together. I want to make a little point before I describe the four cornerstones. There's nothing new here, right? I'm not discovering anything. I'm not putting myself out as somebody that's got any new ideas here, all right? And I do love a tortured analogy. So if you'll forgive me for a tortured analogy, the way I think of this is like your school prom, okay? I don't know what age your prom start, but let's say you're about 13. People are a bit awkward. And you go in and standing around the corners are a bunch of groups of people. They're all little groups, kind of all standing, looking at each other, looking like that, right? And over there, you've got the neuroscientists who are doing amazing things on understanding how the brain lights up, which bits light up when you are happy or fearful. Over there are the behavioral psychologists, the behavioral finance people, understanding why we do certain things. You've got the cognitive biases people next to them because they're kind of friendly, but also daggers at each other. Then you've got the academics, Elizabeth Dunn, Sonny Libomirsky, who are doing amazing research. You've got financial planners like me who are saying, well, let's take all of this and apply it into the actual process. And then over there, you've got the Buddhists who are going, yeah, what? We've been doing this for years, guys. You know? So 2,500 years ago, some bloke sat in a wood and worked it all out. You know, there is nothing new in all of this stuff. We just constantly rediscover what people have already discovered over the years, but we're forgetting it, which is why the wouldn't start from here bit is so important. Because if we start from the right place, all of this old stuff reveals itself to us and we go, oh, that's what it's all about. If I hadn't been so busy trying to get more and be successful, I'd have noticed what Buddha said or whatever your religion might be. It's all in there. They've got all the answers. Anyway, so the four cornerstones are my way of...
Can I say something, Chris? I don't like interrupting, but I've read a lot of academic papers, a lot of books, the researchers you mentioned. I fondly read their papers and love them. What I think you bring new here is all those people standing in the dance, you know, awkwardly. At the beginning, you said that you like to I can't remember the exact words, but you like to start the party. You like to get the party going and back off. It feels like to me, your book is an accumulation of having a party with all these people and they're no longer arms crossed and having a very insightful and engaging
big huddle in the middle.
Big huddle in the middle. Yeah. So that is a new idea. It's bringing all those people together. So
yeah.
That was my interpretation.
That's very kind. So I also have read a lot of academic papers, except let's be honest, Sean, we both read a lot of executive summaries of academic papers, right?
And conclusion. And conclusions.
Okay. So here's my
discussion.
Every single conclusion from every academic paper I've ever read has been exactly the same. What is it?
Well, it's going to, this is how it can be applied. There needs to be further research, opportunities
to
research.
That's it. This is our conclusion. However, further research, aka grants, are needed. I'm being a bit cynical there. So the four cornerstones are: what's true of all of us that makes us happy? What is true of you that makes you happy? What's true of all of us that stops us from being happy? And what's true of you that stops you from being happy? So the general truths, the research, the provable stuff, the know thyself, understanding yourself and what makes you happy, the behavioral stuff that gets in the way, and barriers I think of as our self-limiting beliefs, the things that stop us, that are unique to us and our background. So those are the four areas, are the four cornerstones, I call them, that tries to bring all this different stuff together. Now, the know thyself is, I think, probably the most challenging part, partly because one of the universal truths is we all are programmed to think that more is good. More is the objective. So we have barriers to knowing ourselves, which is why I'm personally of the view that you should always use somebody else to help you to challenge your assumptions. I think it's very hard to challenge your own assumptions. So that's why I'm a big advocate of financial advisors and planners getting trained in coaching skills. And I don't mean anything deep here. I just mean good listening and questioning skills. I can talk about that if you want to go back to that. So the know thyself stuff is, we know that meaning and purpose, doing something kind, will create joy. For me, that was setting up a local youth cricket club. For you, it would be something completely different. For somebody else, it might mean pottery. We all have our own. I buy and sell records at a local vinyl, a local market there. That's one of the things I do for mine. And I love having the conversations with the little old ladies who tell me that they saw Jimi Hendrix in 1967. You know, I love that stuff. So that's where I get mine from. It's all different for all of us. Everybody gets theirs from different places. But because we tend to be, certainly my experience with financial advisors, so many people have head down, trying to achieve goals, just trying to get through life very often. Let's be honest. It's not always easy to spend a bit of time thinking, well, what would make me happy, actually? There's a lot in there. There's on the barrier side, there's permission. You know, permission's a fascinating subject. I know as a father, a husband, a business owner, therefore looking after lots of employees, the idea that I could do something just for me was a revelation. So I asked permission. In fact, a quick story. I went to my firm was called Ovation Finance, and I went to my first employee, who's still there, Vicky, and I said to her, look, I got this idea. I might go to a four-day week, and on Wednesdays, I'll start writing novels because I think that might be the thing that will stop me from being a bit depressed. But I'm really worried about the impact it will have on all the other employees if they see me slacking off. What do you think, Vicky? And she said, well, everybody else is part-time. Why shouldn't you be? And I suddenly realized that person left because she had young kids and she left for the school run. That person only wanted to do 4 days. Everybody else had flexibility except for me. And Vicky telling me that gave me permission to be happy. So permission is a fascinating area. So yeah, know thyself, spending time to understand what it means to you and what will bring you joy and purpose, and applying some of those general truths.
I think in this day and age, with so much access to information and information of what other people are doing on social media, it becomes very hard to, your second point here, know what makes you happy. That we like, back to your external, we search for these external things that we think are going to make us happy because we see it on social media. But that part is so important. And I want to then link this part of what individually makes you happy, or what individually success is to this financial coaching realm that you briefly talked about. How can giving someone permission and coaching go hand in hand, if anything at all?
Just to be clear, there's some confusing terminology around at the moment, certainly in the UK. But when I talk about coaching for advisors, I'm simply talking about what we might call interpersonal skills, listening skills, questioning skills. By the way, good questioning skills are simple questioning skills. There is a rise of financial coaching, which will get much deeper into the psychology of somebody's relationship with money. I love that stuff. Mm-hmm. I think it's great. But that's not what I'm talking about when I talk about coaching skills. So just to be clear on that.
Sorry, bringing the coaching skills to the conversation.
Yeah. So what it'll mean is that, I mean, I remember being taught how to do an initial meeting with a client, right? And there was a video. I always remember this. It was on a compliance supervisor course I went on years ago. And they said, this is the perfect meeting. And the advisor came in and said, hello, Mr. and Mrs. Client, shook their hand, sat down behind a table, got out a piece of paper, a questionnaire, which was 20 pages deep, and went, can I have your name? Wrote down the name. Can I have your date of birth? Wrote down the date of birth, and went through the entire fact find of information. At the end of it, I said, that will never, ever happen in my firm. And we had a bit of an argument about it. In our innovation, what you do is you ask an open question and you shut up. Coaching skill, as much as anything, is what you're doing so well, Sean, is not talking. There's a lot of research. The Nancy Klein book is a famous one about the use of silence, allowing other people to think. But we're trained to provide solutions. That's what education does. It says, here's a set of information in the exam. There is an answer. You've got to find it. So advisors are trained technically to find answers. Whereas in this know thyself space, you want to help the client to find their own answers that aren't based on your values and judgment, but on their values and judgments. This is not an easy thing to do. Really not an easy thing to do. I got my diploma after 2 years and I still do coaching now. And I can't honestly say I'm particularly good at it because I still go, oh, I can see your answer. And then you kind of coach somebody towards the answer you've spotted. And I'll give a quick example of this. There was a guy I was coaching who owned a child day nursery for little kids. He had 3 sites and he had no management team and he was running the whole thing himself. He had 4 kids of his own under the age of 6 and he was working 6.5 days a week. So we were talking and after a half an hour, I did a quick sense check and said, can I make sure I understand what you're looking to achieve here? That you're working 6.5 days a week, you're the only person in the management team, so you want a new management team in order to reduce your working hours to spend more time with your family. And he said, no, I want a management team because I want to open up another site and grow the business. I'm quite happy with how much I see my family. Now, they ain't my values, right? But I have to coach him to his values and what he wants. So being quiet, use of silence, just asking a simple question. When you get to retirement, then what will happen? By the way, everybody then says, oh, I want to travel. So then you say, great, that sounds like a lot of fun. When you finish traveling, then what will happen? And then you just wait and keep silent. One last little story on that use of silence. We run a program in the UK called the Financial Wellbeing Certificate. And one of the things is about use of silence. And we gave everybody the challenge to go away on your next Zoom call, have a meeting with somebody, see how long you can not speak for. But there comes a moment, ask a particular question. The client starts to think and they go quiet. You've got to stay quiet. So this guy came back the following week and he said, I've got a great story. I must share this with you. I asked the client about his retirement. What were you planning to do? And the client started thinking. And so I thought, this is it. This is the way I've got to sleep, not say anything. Normally I would jump in with some suggestions. Didn't say anything. Client's still thinking. 20 seconds go by. 30 seconds go by. This is a long time to have absolute silence on a Zoom call. Then a minute goes by. And still the client's thinking until suddenly the advisor realizes that the Zoom call had frozen. But I was so proud of it. We're going for a whole minute. You know, that was brilliant.
You know, you said something that really stuck with me. It's that you said, aren't your values, and this is when we were talking about like advisors or anyone, like why coaching communication is beneficial is because we're not imparting our values. And back to the silence, it's not very often we get asked probing questions and then just get to sit with the silence to come up with what's percolating in ourselves. And I think that goes back to this, what makes you happy and what makes you unhappy parts of your cornerstone is that when we're not imparting our own values on people, we get to really give them that permission you speak of to just be themselves. Someone told me from the UK, when you see someone, it gives them permission to be themselves. And I really thought that was powerful.
Yeah. Look, I think the first thing to acknowledge is that this is not easy. Simple, but it's not easy. We have to untrain ourselves. And a lot of these things, whether it's what are our goals, what are our objectives in life, more, what is success, comparison, getting out of the habit of comparing yourself, all of this thing is not easy. And for advisors and planners to sit in front of a client and wholly make it about them will not come naturally. We, even just in the way that you nod, the way we act in social situations are all about wanting to be accepted and be liked. And so consequently, somebody says something and you go, oh. Well, in a coaching situation, you've just confirmed to the other person that what they've said is correct. There is a danger of that, at least. So getting out of that and being neutral, what's called clean questioning, is really tough and takes training and practice and ongoing practice as well.
Yet, not yet. However, I guess is the word I'm going to use. The benefit of that is deepening our relationships with ourselves so that we can then, I guess, steer our boat in the direction that is that purpose and meaning that you've talked about, where we can then use money as just this real tool. We always talk about use money as a tool, but I think we're bashing it all the time on the wrong things. What I'm really hearing you say today and through your books is when we approach this relationship with money from financial well-being perspective with your four cornerstones, we can really use money as a tool to fulfill that purpose and meaning. Would that be
a somewhat correct summary? Yeah, I would say rather than saying, how can I use my money to be happy? We should say, how can I be happy? What's money got to do with it? Now, we should just add a little caveat here. It's very easy to say all of this stuff when we're both sitting in nice houses with a bookshelf behind us, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, for some people, you do need a bit more money to be just live or to be happy. So we mustn't be too smug about this. But actually, if you come at this from a different angle, the amount of money you need to be happy, in my experience, is generally an awful lot less than you thought it would be. I find the subject of does more money make you more happy really fascinating, partly because there's some conflicting research out there. I don't think the research is done on this yet. The theology was done a long time ago, but the academics haven't done their piece. I don't think they're finished yet, personally. My conclusion is that more money will make you more happy if you need money to be happy.
It's so good.
So one last thing, if I may, and that is I can just, if you wouldn't mind, just do a very quick plug for something. Is that all right, Sean?
Yeah, absolutely.
But it's very relevant. So I've been working for a few years now on something which I'm hoping to launch in the next few months or next 6 weeks, actually, mainly for UK, but I'm hoping that the US might find it quite interesting as well. It's called the Financial Wellbeing Pulse. It's literally, Sean, you heard it here first when it comes to America.
So Canada.
It's the worst thing you could possibly say to a Canadian. I'm so sorry.
That's okay.
It's like being in New Zealand and saying that you're from Australia. Sorry. I do apologize. So the idea is that it's a measurement tool. You are what you measure, right? You value what you measure. And it's a way of measuring somebody's financial well-being, by which I mean my full definition of the relationship with money. And so what you do is the advisor or planner or anybody else goes to see a client and sends a link. The client completes the survey about 10 minutes or so, and they get a score. Your financial well-being is 52%. And they get a short report explaining what that means and a few hints and tips about some of their answers. They then go and see their advisor, and the advisor can have a conversation with them about the well-being. A period later, whether it's 6 months, 12 months, whatever period for your next review, the client does it again, and now they have a new score, 62%. Now you can say that you, the advisor, have increased the financial well-being of your client by 10 percentage points. A firm can collect that data across all its clients. It's now got data that it can use for marketing, for training purposes, most importantly, to prove the impact of their advice on their clients' well-being and lives. Dead simple to use. It's very low cost. And I said to my wife when I sold my company to my employees, something called an employee ownership trust, about in 2018. And I said to my wife, she said, what are you going to do next? And I said, I want to change the UK financial services and UK financial advice so that it focuses not on money, but on well-being. And she kind of looked at me and went, okay, darling, good luck with that. And then she said to me a few months ago, she said, you actually are, aren't you? You're actually getting there. This is the one, this pulse. If people are starting to measure their well-being and their relationship with money, not measure their investment portfolio growth, because who really cares about that? Let's face it. It's important, but I don't go to the garage so that my mechanic can tell me how the engine works. I don't care. Just, you know, you're the expert. And yet, so why do we talk to clients about investments? If we can get them talking to them about money instead and measuring it, that over the next 10 years will become the direction of travel for financial advice in the UK, and I hope maybe in Canada and North America too.
What a fascinating project. We're so accustomed to those percentage increase in our portfolio, rates of return. And to your point, at the end of life, who cares? Did I have a good life? Not who cares. Of course, we need the money, but did I live a good life is important. Very important.
Or did I beat the index? You know, I always felt that when a client comes to see a financial advisor, and I paid somebody to do my financial planning for me. Because of that, you can't challenge your own assumptions principle. So I'm on the end of this stuff. Go to a financial advisor. What the client is saying is, look, I've got this money. It's a bit scary, to be honest. I don't understand it. Can I just give it to you so that I don't have to think about it again? And the financial advisor says, yeah, no problem. Come back in 2 weeks and I'll show you the investment portfolio I've designed for you. The one thing that they don't want to talk about. So if we can move that along and get people talking to their clients about their lives and their well-being, a lot of which happens, that's that financial, that planning, that part two. But if we can also start applying the theories that are already out there of what makes us happy, we can be helping people to get to a happier life, not the life that they thought that they should be getting to because that's what they saw somebody on telly or on social media doing.
Chris, this has been so wonderful for me. I feel like I could talk to you for another 3 hours. I wanted to talk to you. Maybe we'll have round two where we can talk about your vinyl record collection and how it goes against being satisfied and how you need more and more on that one. But
so the records bit, we were talking before we started this. I think this is an example I often give about spending. So there's a whole thing about spending and something I call the financial well-being junkies, where we are all retail therapy. We're all buying short-term zaps of happiness to get over the terrible stuff that's going on in life. So I'm feeling a bit fed up. I'll go and buy something. Retail therapy was a phrase used, first of all, I think by the Chicago Tribune, 1940 something or other, to describe people maniacally buying at Christmas to try and make themselves happy. It's not a good thing. And yet we use it, retail therapy, let's go and buy. We use it to describe a good thing, but it's not a good thing. Or is it? Now, I've got a hard drive with all my music on it. And if you play the first track and then you keep playing every single track on my hard drive until you get the very last track, it will take you 137 years to get through all my music, right? I'm still buying more records, but I can afford to. And therefore, it's okay. It's a habit I know I've got. I am a junkie when it comes to vinyl, but as long as it's not causing me financial problems, it's okay. So let's, again, just dial it down a little bit. If we can start financial education by teaching them about stuff like this, like retail therapy being a bad thing and financial well-being junkies, we can help people get better with their spending habits by themselves, by education, not necessarily teaching them budgeting, et cetera, although the two go beautifully hand in hand. But the vinyl example is just a way of saying we also must stop being too judgmental on people and look at where these are causing problems. So that's what that was all about.
I really appreciate that answer. And I know your son here, you're making me think of, I did an interview with a professor out of, I think, University of Texas, and he studies why we should spend money on experiences. And we focused on music experiences and how we shouldn't be like, no, I can't go because there's this like anticipation reward, there's the experiencing it and this remembering. So my question is to you, as a music guy, what was your best concert you've ever experienced?
Oh, well, here's the most pretentious thing you'll hear this year. Okay. I love this line. Thank you for the opportunity. As I wrote in my first novel,
Yes.
I describe the place in my first novel. So just before kids, me and my wife had a holiday to New Orleans. And we knew a guy who ran a record shop there, an English guy who ran a record shop there. And he recommended that we go and see the Rebirth Brass Band in the Maple Leaf Club.
I've seen them there.
No way.
I've seen them there. Look, hey, there's New Orleans right there. But I have seen them in the Maple Club.
There you go. There you go.
Yeah. I'm sorry, not to steal it. I just can't believe you said that.
I know. There you are. It was the most extraordinary experience from start to finish, including the taxi there, including being in the place. It's say we were fish out of water would be, you know, putting it mildly. The guy, Frenchie, on the right-hand side up at some ladders doing a painting, a picture. The fact that there was no stage, there were no lights. The guy just stood up and undid the light bulb. That was the house lights going down, you know, the whole thing. Yeah. And then this extraordinary music for 2 hours. It's absolutely brilliant.
Wonderful. Thank you for sharing that. Can I get a 30-second answer here? Because I've asked 172 people this question, and it's very much applied to what we've been talking about, but I've asked everyone. So let's imagine you're at end of life now. I'm going to speed this question up. You're sitting on the front porch. You're looking at a view that brings you peace, ease, and contentment. You decide to write your son's kid a letter on what you've learned is a key to have a happy, healthy relationship with money. What would be a theme to that letter?
I'm going to go with my first thing that came into my head, Sean, which might not be the best or most eloquent, but it's also my social media policy. It's how I try and go through life myself. And it's certainly the advice I would give my son's or my daughter's children, which would be this: don't be a dick.
I like it. Goes back to your kindness, except it has a little bit more oomph to it.
Well, what not being a dick means will be different for everybody, but I think we all know some basic principles of what not being a dick is.
Yeah.
So that gives you a little bit of wriggle room, but also says, yeah, you know, start with kindness.
Well, Chris, thank you so much. I will link to your podcast, your website, the Institute. Is there anywhere else you would like the listeners to go or for me to include in the show notes?
Amazon and BioWare Books. But one of the things about writing novels is that everybody assumes that if they know you and you've written a novel, it must be rubbish. So my third novel, The Vanishing Point, I'm really, really proud of. The first one was the first book from somebody. The second one lost my audience completely, although I secretly love it. It's quite dark. But the third one, The Vanishing Point, I'm really, really proud of. And people that have read it, I get wonderful reviews from it. So yeah, I don't get to talk about that very often. So that would be quite cool.
Okay. We will include that and I am going to read it. Thank you, Chris. This has been delightful. I appreciate your time. Thank you for tuning in this week to the Most Hated F-Word podcast. I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Chris as much as I did. I highly encourage you to check out his books, including The Vanishing Point, as I heard it is an excellent read. Until next week, have yourself a good one. I'm on a mountain without a top. My wealth is measured in how I spend my time. But now I write a freedom story with every breath inhaled. Money is not the boat of life, it's just the wind. Say